This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and good morning. Welcome to The Morning Run on BFM 89.9, the business station. I'm Melissa Idris with Julian Ng and Sharad Kutan this morning. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
It's so great to be here on a Thursday because Thursday means it's a day before Friday, and Friday means the weekend.
And it's an extra long weekend and an extra short week next week.
So many things to look forward to. Also, the Kuala Lumpur Festival is coming up this weekend.
Yes,
on Saturday and Sunday.
You're going to be moderating a session?
No, unfortunately. I'm not. But I will be at the Ilham Gallery on Saturday, the 10th, to moderate a discussion about Dr. Mahathir's legacy. So if you're interested in Dr. Mahathir's legacy amidst actually an exhibition of art that was created during that period, and art commissioned in response to that 22 years in power, then head down to Ilham Gallery. It's a new building right next to what used to be the Nico Hotel, Ampang Park LRT station.
I see.
That's where it is. It's a fabulous new art space. And so I'm going to be moderating a talk there on Saturday.
I never know how to act in galleries. Sorry to interrupt you, Jules. But you know when you go in and then you kind of pause at a...
You try
painting.
To look intellectual.
Yeah, yeah.
You
like,
stand
like
in front of a building.
The painting speaks to you.
for about 30 seconds, and eventually you absorb the intellectualism around
you. But also you have to kind of
by osmosis?
Yes,
true.
By osmosis.
It's like listening to night school.
Ah, well, you can also... the other way is actually to follow the argument... and then question it, really, because...
That sounds like hard work.
Well, you know, strangely, some of the best things in life and the greatest pleasures come from working hard.
Okay, well...
Hey, I've never been to a Kuala Lumpur event.
Really?
What is it about?
It's a literary festival. So
literary and a little more. It's kind of a festival of ideas.
That's a really good way to explain it. Yeah, festival of ideas, where you come together and kind of... think about how you would make, the country, your situation, the arts better.
Yeah, and also they have all kinds of panels. And last year's Kuala Lumpur Festival actually had Dr. Mahathir as a guest, you remember?
Yes.
And of course they have, they've had journalists from Hong Kong and around the world, writers, novelists as well, because that's that literary dimension.
This year they've got a whole host of speakers, including the former managing editor of NPR is going to be speaking about the quality of journalism at the moment.
Yeah, and also with that John Dingus panel, which I was supposed to have had a conversation with him, the question that really at stake is, you know, the media and democracy and that relationship, not to be presumed or assumed, really, but a question that needs to kind of be renewed every so often.
Kuala Lumpur Festival happening on Saturday and Sunday. Check it out. It's going to be at Publica. You can always Google for more information on that. But very quickly, guys, let's talk about what's coming up over the next 4 hours. On the breakfast grill, we'll have Dato' Yu Hong Chu, Deputy Chairman of iBerhad. Now, they are the guys behind the iCity development in Shah Alam.
Yeah, I've been there. The one with all the LED lights, LED LED theme park.
What an idea. Oh, yeah. And, you know, a very popular one, especially if you're...
It's what you call a bright idea.
Too early in the morning, Julian. Too early in the morning. I do think, though, I mean, I think it's pretty... I think aesthetically, it's a bit wanting because...
Because it's not an art gallery, Sharad.
Well, I don't know. Okay, I must admit, I've only ever seen it in pictures and from a distance.
You can see it from space.
You should go.
But people like that.
It's a totally surreal experience.
It's a theme park. So what they've done is, you know, they're a property developer, but they're really positioning themselves to be part of this kind of theme park hospitality, because that's the recurring income line for them. You know, once you sell a property, you sell a property. But with theme parks, you know, you're constantly getting tickets. With hotels, the charges, and you know, even car parks, they're positioning themselves as car parks to have, you know, recurring incomes from their car parks.
Yeah, I think a car park would be a great theme park idea.
But think of all the concrete.
When you were a child.
It's very Banksy. Okay. It's very dystopic. Yes. A car park theme park.
Yeah. Dystopic is the word. Yeah. Now, when you were a child, did you want to go to Disneyland?
Of course.
I did go to Disneyland.
Oh, you did go to Disneyland as a child?
I went to Disneyland as an adult. No, I always wanted to go as a child, but okay, so finally went as an adult.
See, that's the thing. Mm. I don't think I would want to go to Disneyland now. Even if somebody sort of said, hey, do you want tickets to Disneyland? I wouldn't go.
Not today. I mean, today I'd rather go to something like Universal Studios or something. But as a child...
I thought you'd want to go to Tuscany and, you know, enjoy wine, cheese and bread.
I went to the Universal Studios in Singapore and I had such a good time there. It was great.
Really? I don't think I could go to a theme park anymore.
Bring out your inner child, Sherrod. There's something fun about cotton candy and rides.
Corn dogs.
Yes.
I don't even know. What is that? Is that like a species of dog?
It's a deep-fried hot dog. It's so good.
Look. Honestly, I must admit, that inner child of me has grown up.
Oh, okay.
You go to things like Kuala Lumpur. Because you're kind of cool.
Definitely. I would choose the Kuala Lumpur Festival over Disneyland and rubbing shoulders with a life-size version of Mickey Mouse.
The only Disneyland that I've been to is the one in Hong Kong, and I was utterly bored out of my wits.
Really? Was it just the long queues, or you just didn't have fun at the rides?
I think it was too kiddie for me.
Okay, all right. Well, Iberhard really still banking on their theme park. One area is how do they keep that fresh, right? Because after you go a while, I mean, you know, the novelty's worn off. But clearly, they are really going gangbusters on their ICT development. Let's find out more on the Breakfast Grill.
Kitsch sells.
Kitsch. Oh, kitsch. Kitsch sells, you're right. We have current affairs today and our focus is going to be on the ASEAN summit in Laos. We're going to be speaking to Prashant Parameswaran from The Diplomat, which is based in Washington, D.C. He mainly writes about Southeast Asia security affairs and the relationship between U.S. and this part of the world. So quite interesting because, you know, Obama made several statements during the summit talking about how even if it is his last term, even if he's... leaving office, Asia will remain a huge focus for the U.S. There have been concerns that, you know, Obama was behind this pivot to Asia approach. And now if he's leaving, will Hillary, if she gets into the White House, continue that? And if it's a Trump presidency, what will that mean?
Yeah, in fact, during Lee Hsien Loong's visit, Lee Hsien Loong, the Prime Minister of Singapore, his visit to Washington in August, Obama said, and I quote him, "The United States has been a Pacific nation for over two centuries. That's not going to change. The reality transcends election cycles." But I guess it's the reality also needs a boost in terms of resources, in terms of policy priorities.
A champion, right? This look at Asia. I don't think he calls it pivot to Asia. I think there's another name that the U.S. uses for it. But it'll need a champion. And if Obama is not going to be that champion anymore, will his successor take up that mantle? And if he or she doesn't, then what does that mean for Asia, right? We could see a lot fewer visits to this part of the world.
Yeah, I do think, in fact, it is called the pivot to Asia.
Is it still called?
Yeah, I think so. Okay. Just to fact check Mr. Obama a little bit, the United States has been a Pacific nation for two centuries. Is that correct? Because what about the Iraq campaigns and the Middle Eastern,
I think what
Latin
he means,
American?
He's just talking geography. The geography of America is that it has its Atlantic coast and it's got its Pacific coast.
Okay.
And when you think about the trade across the Pacific, and that's pretty old. I mean, if you think of the Manila Galleon, right? The trade that went basically from Mexico to China via the Philippines.
So this is the geographical aspects of where they are, not the fact that they are war-hating nation.
War-hating nation?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think they are war-hating.
That's what Pacific means, right?
I think Pacific only here is a reference to the geography. You're right. I mean, America has been, and Obama said this himself, I mean, focus on the Middle East and Europe. But, and so his pivot to Asia is a policy reorientation, right? But he, what he's saying is that America can't run away from the fact that it remains a central part of the geopolitical sphere that is defined in geographical terms, right? You have China on one side, China, especially now that China's a rising power. You know, American
certainly
can no longer
not
take
Pacific. China is. I think it's China is more. China is more Southeast Asia, South China Sea East.
Okay. All right, we've taken it off tangent.
Words, yes.
Wordplay in the morning. There you go. It's very early for wordplay. But a good look at what's happening in Laos with the ASEAN Summit at 8:35 a.m. And also on Ringgit and Cents today at 9:35 a.m. We're going to get a financial literacy coach and chartered financial consultant on the show. Bose Darson will be telling us how the ASB and EPF can help you be a millionaire at retirement. And there's a twist, right, Jules?
There is actually a twist using quite an unorthodox method that's not really recommended or popular in financial planning circles. So you got to stay tuned to do that. But
teaser.
Never mind the fact that the doubts and the question of whether being a millionaire would mean anything
nowadays.
At your
retirement. At retirement.
Nowadays even, let alone at your retirement, right?
Well, but a million in denominated ringgit, you mean?
In ringgit, a ringgit heir. A ringgit millionaire. Okay. But at least having something is better than having nothing.
Well, if you're keen to find out, then Ringgit and Cents is the show for you, 9:35 a.m. But very quickly, guys, let's take a look at the news roundup. Al Jazeera has come out with a huge new investigative documentary, which they claim exposes massive corruption at the top of the Maldives government, including theft, bribery and money laundering. And there's a Malaysian element to it because apparently Al Jazeera has found that the president's ministers and aides have plotted to launder up to $1.5 billion through the nation's central bank with the help of businessmen from Singapore, Malaysia and Indonesia.
Wow. Interesting. So again, another explosive expose from the media that looks at these international networks of money laundering. And I'd like to see the details, you know, who are these individuals and are they well placed in these countries?
The Malaysian businessman apparently has denied his involvement in the alleged money laundering scheme. And he has, Malaysia Kini spoke to Faizan Hassan and he has denied any involvement in that.
Actually, if you think about it, the lines between legal money laundering and illegal money laundering are very thin, right? Look at the corporations from the United States around the world, how they are escaping tax by stashing their hundreds of billions of dollars, even trillions of dollars outside of the United States. So taking themselves out of the purview of the tax man. I think that's money laundering because you're depriving your own nation of tax income.
But that's tax evasion, which is a legal loophole, right?
Yeah, potato, you know, it's
tomato.
It's taking money away from the country. And, you know, so these politicians are thinking, hey, you know, if the corporates can do it legally, why can't we do it under the radar? Because it's the same thing anyway.
Also in the US, Senate lawmakers returned from summer recess and have blocked a $1.1 billion bill to fund combating the Zika virus. Now, the same funding measures fell twice under similar margins in June and July. So they're going to get another stab at this at, I think, next month. But so far, it's a stalemate in the Senate.
Interesting. Just a quick note on Julian's play on words. The person who gave the name Pacific to the Pacific Ocean was Ferdinand Magellan. He called it the Pacific Ocean after the idea of peace, peaceful seas, because he went through the stormy seas of Cape Horn. And once he got to the Pacific Ocean, he thought, wow, This is a peaceful ocean.
It probably landed on Hawaii and thought, wow, how beautiful.
We're probably talking nautical peace as well, you know, like the choppy seas, etc.
That's in 1519, by the way,
long time ago, before we were all born.
Okay, just coming back to the topic of Zika, the first pregnant woman with Zika has been reported back home here in Malaysia. This is Malaysia's third reported case of the virus as well. And 6:15 now, we'll be back with a look at what happens when you mix hip-hop and ballet. The answer of that is you get hip play. We'll tell you more after this on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Swing That Thing by Luke Winslow King. Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run. 6:20 on the clock. I'm Melissa Idris with Sherrod Kutten and Julian Ng. And as promised, we're talking about hip play this morning, the hybrid of hip-hop and ballet. And the reason we're talking about it is because apparently this is the new thing now. There was a video that had some young girls who were typically dressed, ballet dancers, dancing to hip-hop music, dancing ballet to hip-hop music.
So they were dancing in ballet, in tutus,
yeah,
and
in ballet shoes.
You know, honestly, ballet and dance, you know, and contemporary dance, a mixture of styles has been happening for the longest time. You mm-hmm. know, it's exciting that, you know, you have these forms, but I'm not quite sure. Is it seen as particularly sort of groundbreaking, this fusion of hip-hop and ballet?
Yeah, I think what he wanted to establish, and this was created by this guy named Homer Hans Bryant. He is the artistic director and founder of the Chicago Multicultural Dance Center. And he really wanted to bring ballet, which was seen as kind of a mostly white, upper class, elitist sort mm-hmm. of art to the masses. And so what better way to do it and to really expose ballet to the African American by combining it with hip hop?
What do you think of ballet? Just ballet, classical ballet?
Kind of Russian ballet. Yeah, I think it's extraordinarily beautiful. They've got their own, you know, aesthetics. It was developed in a specific period of Russia's own development artistically. You know, and very quickly, you know, the Russians experimented and, you know, developed the kind of contemporary dance forms as well. You think of you know, the works of Night.
No idea.
Rites of Spring, okay. You know, and all that. I mean, and even with the African American scene, I mean, we have groups like, you know, the choreographer Alvin Ailey, you know, from the 70s and 60s. They were breaking boundaries for the longest time. So for me, it's like, you know, because I was very lucky. I grew up in Singapore at the time that they were trying to promote the arts. So what they did was they set up a channel specifically on kind of cultural programming. And so on television, we got dance performances by Merce Cunningham, Twyla Tharp, Alvin Ailey. And just that sheer exposure, even on television. Television is kind of a limited form, but you saw that, you know, the world of dance was so vast.
Well, if you talk about the world of classical ballet specifically, I would have to say that I agree with Jules. I mean, it does feel very elitist to me. It feels like only ballet is only for a select group of people who are part of this world and who are audience to these performances.
Well, you know, that's because, you know, these are imports, right? So it's like some people think that, you know, McDonald's is some sort of, you know, mid-brow
McDonald's is
cuisine.
McDonald's is
you know, it's very
elitist.
Working class in it. Yeah, well, it isn't. But what I'm saying is that
I think it depends
that get
on
imported.
The price point. I think it probably would not be cheap to learn or watch ballet.
We probably
anywhere.
Think European opera is, you know, high class and elitist.
High-brow,
when in fact,
I think they are.
In fact, it's not. I mean, in Europe, in Italy, I mean, you know, everybody listens to opera. I mean, opera is sung in the language of native peoples. We get here and it's Italian. It's a foreign language because it sounds, you know, highbrow.
I visited an opera performance one I attended, and they had subtitles and it was really quite good.
Yeah,
I enjoyed myself.
So again, coming back to the ballet, right? The ballet doesn't have subtitles. And I'm going to use my own personal experience for this. I went to watch the Nutcracker, a ballet performance during Christmas season, and I had no idea what the story of Nutcracker was. And I didn't read the program or anything. So when, even if you do read the program, you know, you just know the basic outline of the story. So the whole time during the dance, the performance, you're trying to interpret what the dance, are they doing this now? Is this the part where the tin soldier comes out? What's going on? Is this a fairy? What's happening?
So question, did you have to go in an evening dress to attend this?
Yeah, atas lah, yeah. I got
to dress up for it, right? And the gentlemen had to put on their jackets as well. The Petronas Philharmonic Hall a long time ago had this policy where you cannot enter into the performance without a jacket.
Well, they loosened it so much.
They would give you the jacket. And I guess in an effort, and also perhaps in an acknowledgement that this is too highbrow, they discarded with that rule. And today you can go into Petronas in
jeans, more casual.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, the charge that these arts are elitist really is something that's become too easy a kind of criticism to lay at the feet of a lot of culture. Because, you know, and maybe it's a question of price, but ultimately, you know, none of these things, even in Kuala Lumpur, cost more than a couple of happy meals at in a drive-in. And if you try, I think
you can... When was the last time you bought a happy meal, Sharad? They actually cost a lot more.
Actually, when I went to watch...
The price of a ticket to say see the ballet.
About 200 something ringgit per person or 200 per person was what I paid for the recent Studio Ghibli performance in Petronas Philharmonic. And that's not cheap, right?
Yeah, but at the end of the day, okay, let's just, apart from the question of price, the question really is of, because that could be resolved by subsidies, state subsidies for the arts and bring down the price of tickets and increase access. I went to Akram Khan, you know, dance company's performance in Penang. They brought in students. They gave 200 tickets away to school children. They bust them in to get expose them to this contemporary dance, performance.
So, do you think that with hip hop, the mash between hip hop and ballet, the fact that it's the music that's changed, right? So, the video that Mr. Bryant had choreographed was to the music of Jason Derulo, which is, you know, mainstream hip hop, radio friendly. So that feels more accessible. That appeals to certain type of demographic and community, as opposed to classical ballet music, which is set to an orchestra piece and you know, a symphony arrangement.
Yeah, but it's still music. I mean, you know, you go
but it's not as accessible as a Jason Derulo hit song.
I don't know. I mean, if you go and listen to classical music, if you know, you will find yourself, if you listen to, you know, Johann Sebastian Bach, I don't know if it's classical, but you know, but the music that we identify as classical might be a more kind of academic definition for that, but it does grip you. I mean, it's in your body. You feel that music. And, you know, you go to opera and you listen to a soprano kind of belt out some song, you'll feel it in your body because all these art forms really speak to you. If you're open to it, I think they really do resonate with you, you know, on a visceral level. Maybe not intellectually, maybe you don't know enough about the history of it, you don't know the specifics of that performance, you didn't read the program, whatever. You feel it in your body. I mean, you're transported by the sheer beauty of the spectacle, you know, on one hand.
Have you guys learned how to dance?
You know, when I was a kid, I took a ballet.
Well, like ballet, something classic, like formal.
Some formal lessons.
I took a ballet class when I was a child. Okay. Yeah, and apparently my turnout wasn't very good. You know the turnout where you have to do the ballet thing? You have to put your feet heel to heel? My turnout was atrocious, so I never continued.
I was given a present once by a French girl, no less.
Ooh.
Who gave me salsa lessons for my birthday.
With her?
And with the instructor.
Oh.
And it happened in the hotel hall, right, where this instructor would just teach people how to dance. And it turned out to be a total disaster for me because I couldn't memorize any of the moves. I was horrible on
the dance floor. What is salsa again? What kind of dance?
It's a very sexy dance.
Is it the Spanish?
Latin,
like cha-cha-cha.
I had more luck with tango, though. Tango is, as especially the modern kind, is a lot more accessible.
The Georgetown Festival brings in some great dance performances. I watch Akram Khan. He's Bangladeshi, British choreographer. I also watched flamenco. I had traditional flamenco music. And this was interesting because it was also the music of the Maghreb, you know, the northwestern part of Africa, and also Spain. And so it was this fusion of the music, which was Arabic in nature, and the flamenco style. Gorgeous. You couldn't leave the hall without loving it. It transported you.
I'm so moved by your passion for that, Sharad. Okay, let's go to the first news bulletin of the day at 6:30 with Keith Kumm on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, The Rolling Stones with Ain't Too Proud to Beg.
Good. Did you feel that? Was that visceral for you?
Was that? That was far more visceral than any ballet performance I've watched.
Or the music from
the music from the ballet classical.
Just really, Swan Lake doesn't stir you. You didn't think of...
Well, I don't think I was tapping my foot and jigging along to it, you know, jiggy with it.
Yeah, get jiggy. I think, we're talking about this, exposure... and openness to different rhythms, different sonic scales. All these things really make a difference in building foundations. I think in this country, we really should have solid arts programs for children, expose them to the whole world of music, all kinds of things, so that they come out being able to make choices, not feeling that, you know, apart from whatever's produced in the US or whatever it is, that they have choices,
right.
You know?
Yeah, and it's not just Western, what you're saying is that we are kind of fully appreciative of our own kind of, our own culture.
Arts and culture.
Yeah, arts and culture.
Jazz
for sure.
Music, for instance, actually requires quite a bit of appreciation.
I agree. Okay, well, let's just continue our discussion that we had yesterday at this time on pandas. Now, if you were tuning in, you'd have heard that pandas are now off the endangered species list. They're now just under, I think, the category of vulnerable. So continuing this, now, instead of saving an endangered species, let's talk about the power that we now have to plan for the extinction of species that we want to eradicate. So there's something called gene drive technology, which is essentially a genetic modification, genetic editing, where you can remove or ensure a particular trait in that species. I'll give you an example. You can have a gene modification of, say, mosquitoes to not be able to carry certain viruses. Now that we have this technology, let's talk a little bit about the ethics of using it.
Yeah, I guess what jumps out to your mind is whether you would screw up the entire ecological system, because it's all a very fine balance, very fragile balance. And if you take something out of the equation, will it tumble down like a house of cards? I don't know. I don't think so, because this is not the first time that we have been through extinction throughout the history of the Homo sapiens. We have, our existence has been coinciding with massive extinctions of many animals around the world, because we like eating, right? We eat up all our animals and we don't plan for our consumption. So we destroy a lot of plants, a lot of animals. I guess it doesn't hurt to take one or two annoying animals out of existence.
Okay.
I would so opt for the extinction of a chicha. I hate
mosquitoes. No, not the chicha. They eat mosquitoes. They are our friends.
Yeah, well, you see, no. See, this is where you get, there might be quite a huge debate as to who gets to live and who gets to die.
Yeah, and who decides,
human beings,
right?
Wanting to play God all the time, or the gods,
but,
as it were.
But
we have been.
But, you know, talking about eating, there is a brilliant book called The Future Eaters by Tim Flannery. If you're interested in Australia, and I think a lot of Malaysians think of Australia as the land of milk and honey, but understanding its own sort of natural history and what happened when human beings first landed on that continent, and the eradication of so many species, because in some ways human beings take several generations to understand the consequences of their actions in the environment, right? they destroyed, I mean, they eliminated many of the big animals of the continent. And Tim Flannery's book, which I believe has been turned into a documentary, is a brilliant way to understand that continent. And I'm going to tweet out the link to that.
Okay, but on the flip side, there are those who argue that, I mean, look, if you have the power to use this technology, this, you know, this biological tool to help conserve nature itself. I'll give you an example. New Zealand has set a goal of eradicating all non-native predators within 35 years in order to protect the country's indigenous wildlife. So they want to use these, they're not using gene drive technology, but they want to find a way to eradicate non-native predators because they say it's harmful to what the natural wildlife. And another example is in Hawaii, if I'm not mistaken. One part of this is to use to eradicate invasive bird harming mice on particular islands. So the way they want to do that is to alter the mice to prevent them from producing female offspring. So by several years, these mice will die out. So what, I mean, this is not for the benefit of for Homo sapiens, but for the benefit of conserving nature.
Which eventually falls back to us. I guess in the case of Australia and New Zealand, they have very sensitive ecological systems. And a lot of these so-called introduced species or animals into their environment actually does a lot of harm and can actually destroy, for example, like the rivers and, you know, the Great Barrier Reef in Australia. That's industrial. A lot of it is industrial. But introduced animals can also have the effect of a kind of very destructive effect.
Yeah, non-native species that were brought together.
So that happened in history. But now how do you correct that, right? So now that we have the technology to correct a mistake we made many, many, many years ago, should we use that power?
I think we should. I think we have a right to.
So you're okay with the idea of using gene drive technology to genetically edit certain species?
I think always the consideration is this. There might be intended consequences of the kind of technological tools that we have, right? So we plan it, and it's the best of the knowledge that science has. They can say this will be the consequence. But there are always unintended consequences in terms of human action. And I think that's something that needs to be kind of highlighted. You say, what kind of unintended consequences that maybe we can't anticipate? Are the risks worth taking? And I think that's something to put in the mix. So we can't assume that just because the technology has or the science has worked out all the permutations, probably not all the permutations.
So let's play out the risk. What do you think are some of the risks that could take place?
Well, I'm actually, personally, I don't have enough of that science to say that because assume that those scientists would have that as well.
So there are two elements of this, right? One that's used to conserve nature and the other to say help save mankind. For instance, the Zika virus, right? Yeah. If we could create, if we could edit mosquitoes' genes to not be able to carry, say, dengue or Zika or any other viruses that they do carry to stop mosquitoes from being a vector, would we want to use that technology? What harm do you see that happening to the ecological system? What unintended consequences?
I don't know. There'll still be around. The whole point about unintended consequences is that many of them can't be anticipated because, you know, of course we can model things. I'm like, you know, I met a theoretical chemist the other day and he talked about how, the ability to get models of chemical reactions together on in an artificial environment like the computer is one thing,
but you need a collider.
The collider is a real. I mean, it's not theoretical. You're not just typing in mathematical formula.
They're trying to discover what happened in the Big Bang.
Yeah, but what I mean is that's real physics, right? I mean, that's a physical. That's an experiment as opposed to doing modeling, right? Which suggests that you can reduce everything to mathematical algorithms.
You can predict.
And you can predict, right, by creating these algorithms. But so you don't actually have to have the real element. So he was saying the reason theoretical chemistry develops is because so many elements that you want to use to experiment are hugely expensive, right? So the one way of doing that is actually to do it without the material. But you need that the other side of chemistry as well, because there are things that you don't cannot anticipate, right?
I think my question to this whole idea of playing God is, what is the higher purpose? Is it to save mankind, or humankind, or is it to save our environment, which are two very, very different things.
Yeah, so right? Is one more noble than the other, though, Jules? Would you use the technology for one and not
the
other?
I think the New Zealand thing, where the targets to become predator-free by 2050, there is an undertone of more of a saving their environment for the benefit of the people, but the higher purpose is to save the environment. But for something like the Zika, is to save ourselves.
Yeah, and babies being born
in the process of saving ourselves, the question is whether there are risks and knock-on effects to other parts of the ecology.
Yeah, so that's the unintended consequences, right? I mean, the expression playing God is an interesting one. I mean, as an atheist, I would use that. I'd say, well, we're trying to play Mother Nature. We're trying to alter the course of the globe's, you know, the Earth's natural history.
That's the same argument that that detractors of GMO, of genetically modified agriculture products, right? They make that claim. You know, you're playing God, you're playing Mother Nature. But I guess that it's a debate that we need to have as a society. We really need to think about these things. It's a difficult conversation for sure, not one that you can have in 10 minutes.
And I think that we have been dealing with this change in kinds of mutations in our environment and our food for centuries. I mean, the kind of foods that we eat today, really, you can argue that nothing is the same from what our ancestors and our forefathers used to eat, you know, 200, 300, even 5,000, 10,000 years ago. That was one of the arguments put forward, that this idea of a paleo diet is a farce, because we cannot find the kinds of food that our caveman ancestors used to eat. The brinjal that we eat today are so different from the brinjal that existed 100,000 years ago. You know, the apple, the strawberries, they're not
corn,
the same.
Yeah, I mean,
so
we
actually have been dealing with genetic mutations for a very long time.
Yeah, but be it natural or man forced, right? Okay, 6:51 right now. We've got the news coming up at the top of the hour. After that, Market Watch with Ben Lebrun with a look at the Australian market. But first, With a Girl Like You by The Troggs on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.